With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. And this week's guest is Rory Sutherland. Rory is the vice chairman at Ogilvy, a world-famous advertising agency founded by the legendary David Ogilvy. Rory's also the author of two books, The Wiki Man and Alchemy, The Surprising Power of Ideas Which Don't Make Sense. I'm glad to say that our conversation went all over the place and we discussed everything from lockdown, behavioral psychology, brands that have succeeded with seemingly terrible products, the role of data in advertising, conservatism and Brexit. The political chat went on for longer than I probably would have anticipated, but I decided to leave it in. Rory's very entertaining on most issues and I think you're going to see why. Yeah, I mean, I've actually given up asking the lockdown question, but I know that you've had sort of strong views on remote working for quite some time, and you're finally seeing your vision come to fruition. How have you been coping personally yourself?
Yeah, everybody assumes I'm a mega extrovert, and I'm not. And that's the weird one. And there was a wonderful meme that I only learned this 2 weeks ago, which is very, very funny. It happened after about 3 weeks of lockdown, which went around. And it simply said, introverts, be kind to extroverts. They don't know how this works. Okay. And of course, anybody who's actually fairly content, with la vie intérieure, in other words, if you give me a book or, YouTube to watch or anything of that kind, I've got one daughter who's even more like this than me in terms of, pretty much there could be a nuclear holocaust and she wouldn't notice for about 4 or 5 days, except the internet would go down, I suppose. It's very interesting because although I'm very happy being sociable, I can only be sociable up to a certain number of hours before I get exhausted and then I want to seclude myself. So one of the reasons I speak to 200 people on stage is I'd rather speak to 200 people for 1 hour than to speak to 10 people for 20 hours, if you see what I mean. If I've got to talk to people, let's condense this into a short time. Apparently, this is common with stand-up comedians. Everybody assumes that stand-up comedians are kind of the people who, after the gig's over and after their set's over, they kind of go to the bar and mingle. And most of them say, no, to be absolutely honest, once you're done, you want to go back to your hotel room and watch Sky News in your pants. And so, oddly, it suits me very well. It also suits me well because I like the freedom. Basically, I work quite long hours. What makes a huge difference to me is if I have discretion over what I do when and where I do it, it makes a huge difference both to my productivity and my general well-being.
Yeah.
So I can't write in the office, just to give an example. I can't write out. I wrote the whole book, every single bloody word of that book. In the end, I took a month and a half off or 2 months off and wrote it down in where I am now, actually, in Deal, which is just on the, if you think of kind of London equivalent of Dorking, that, it's a bit like that. Okay. It's a seaside place about an hour from London. And I wrote the book there and I wrote it at the weekend and I wrote it, in various places. Not a single word was written in the office. And I can't write body copy in the office for advertising. I can't write articles in the office. And so the freedom to actually choose the setting in which you perform functions and the time of day at which you perform it really makes a difference to me.
Yeah.
In terms of if you want to get out high quality work from people, the analogy I always used is if you ask people to solve a cryptic crossword, but they've got to do it in numerical order. So you've got to start with one across, and then do one down and then do two across or five across. Those things are really, really, it's really difficult. The only way you can do a cryptic crossword is by obviously dicking around and going, don't understand that one at all. Let's go to 13 down and then we'll try seven across because now we've got a D. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And allowing people to build their work around the order in which they prefer and the moments in which they find opportune. And the way I describe this is, look, flexible working at a very simple level is just a more intelligent value exchange between the employer and the worker. Because what we used to do is we used to buy people's time. Okay, so the worker sacrificed leisure in exchange for money. And it was a necessity until recently that the worker had to be in a particular place at a particular time. Okay, so there was no freedom. There was free time, which was when you'd finished work, but there wasn't any free when or free where. You had no discretion over when you worked or where you worked. And my argument is, okay, actually, that was still true in 1988, by the way. I mean, I started working in an office in 1988, and there were no laptops. There were kind of enormous Xerox documenters on which you could type or produce presentations, but they were kind of like, you know, I mean, the size of a washing machine or something. All your faxes came into the office. All your phone calls came into your desk phone. There were no mobiles to speak of in 88. And they did exist in 88, but even in a fairly, you know, fairly well-funded ad agency, I don't think anybody had a mobile when I first started work. And of course, they were. You had to carry a battery around with you, didn't you, in the early stages? Then your phone calls came to your desk. Your PA, if you wanted anything typed, you had to be in the office. If you wanted to write anything, you had to be in the office. The photocopier was a thing the size of a car that was in the basement. And so only about 10% of your work was really location or time independent. And of course, that whatever the percentage is, and it varies both by temperament and by the nature of the job you do, it's now well over 20 for a lot of jobs, which means at least one day, probably, if you can get your shit together, doesn't need to be spent in a specific place. And it may be as many as three, it could be five. That's unlikely, you know, that's exceptional. But the point I'm making is that if we develop all these technologies which give us this freedom, and yet we still have a Victorian mode of working where you turn up at nine and you stay there till six, even if you've turned up at nine just to spend the first 2 hours replying to emails, which you could have done from home, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning and then traveled in on an empty train, okay? Even, you know, if we don't offer any of that flexibility, it's a complete failure to find a much more intelligent value exchange between employer and worker where you give them some discretion over the where and the when.
I think even with things like sleep, you know, if somebody if somebody's had a bad night with their child or even, you know, drank too much wine or whatever, and they could do an extra hour in bed and end up being more productive for the day, I think it makes perfect sense.
Well, of course, the interesting thing is then you basically start work. You can start work within 5 minutes of getting up.
Yeah.
10 minutes if you haven't got someone to make you a cup of coffee. But if you put a cardigan over your pajamas, yeah, basically good to go. And you probably need a cup of coffee first thing. After that, you're set. So, you know, even if you have drunk too much, if you get up at 8, if you wake up at 8, you can start work at 8:04. Whereas the alternative is you start work at 10:04. And so I think it's really interesting. I learned a lot of it working with a PA who was a single mum, because I just said, okay, you know, I believe in Adam Smith, but I believe that the instinct, you know, the inside of Adam Smith is that you can find very intelligent ways where people can create value for each other, which is mutually beneficial. And what we did is, I still do this with my current PA, post expenses to home. Because her argument was, look, you know, if I'm going to do something boring like that, I'd much rather pick my son up from school, take him home, spend time with my son until 8 o'clock at night. Then when he's asleep, do your expenses while there's something on the telly or something. Okay. Much rather do that than stay in the office till six doing your bloody expenses. And it made such obvious sense. I said, I don't really care. You know, I don't go, these expenses are no good. They were not done within working hours. You know, and it struck me as so obvious that you could achieve really. And by the way, this applies to a bunch of people. So working mums, obvious example. Anybody who's a carer or has commitments to, say, relatives. Also, by the way, older people, in that how many people do you think retire not because they want to actually stop work, but because they want to stop commuting?
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong. You know, there's a hell of a lot of accountancy you can practice at home. You probably, within reason, not 5 days a week, not 8 hours a day, but probably, you know, 16 hours a week of that stuff, or even 24. That was, by the way, that's what you tend to find, I think. If people don't need to work, people tend to work for about 16 to 20 hours a week. If you give them a kind of private income, they find some shit to do for about 16 to 20 hours of the week just to stave off kind of anomy and boredom. But in the case of, you know, older people, I mean, the extent to which they leave the workforce because they're put off by the commute, not because they're put off by the value-added work, seems to me crazy.
Yeah, even for me, my you know, I have occasional rush hour, I have to get out of London moments just because, you know, there's a deep, you know, inhuman experience of sitting on a train that feels like it's 40 degrees with somebody's armpit in your face. And it's just that feeling of, I just, you know, what am I doing here? And then I can shake that off a bit throughout the day. But yeah, I feel like I'm carrying around a lot of that stress around at me for the rest of the day that I've kind of lost now since lockdown. I'm quite enjoying it.
You know, I mean, if we're going to harm the planet by travelling about, at least make it the form of travel that's informative or interesting, not the form of travel that's done under duress.
Yeah.
You know, and so one of the interesting things is that, you know, I think one of the discoveries we've made over this period is that a slower pace of life, just, you know, less crowded roads, for example, very simple level, it seems to me there's a bit of a return of insect life, clearer skies, so you can, you know, my friend who lives in the Barbican can see the Surrey Hills for the first time in 15 years, 20 years living there. You know, those things are worth having, and we should account for them. And so the fact that we're actually creating a lot of grief, because to me, it was a gross... Now, it's complicated because in order to make Zoom work for you, it's a coordination problem. It requires a change of habit and a change of social norms. And they're very difficult without a pandemic to engineer simultaneously, okay? But it did strike me as a weird failing of businesses, including my own. I did experiment with Zoom with my team 2 years ago, okay? And we did lots of experiments with each other saying, what happens if we all do Zoom Fridays? What happens if we all do it simultaneously? But the fact that this technology had come along, which, you know, if you're a professional services firm, is as important as the internet in some ways, okay? It's certainly more important than email, which we all adopted unthinkingly. And yet, strangely, no one actually sat down and said, well, I can now talk to someone in India at 7 o'clock in the morning. An hour or two later, I can talk to someone in Tbilisi. And I've had days like this, actually, which start in Sydney and go through kind of Tbilisi, Rome, Paris, and then Los Angeles or Hawaii, I think, in one case. Okay. Now, the fact that I can do that is kind of important, okay? Because, you know, Ogilvy could buy me a Learjet and I wouldn't be close to being able to do that. So this is, you know, and this is free, right? Okay. This is basically free. And yet no company, and I jokingly said in my Spectator article, it's as if, you know, the USS Enterprise had a teleporter, but they never got around to unboxing it. You know, they were still sending pods down to the surface of hostile planets. And you know, beam me up, Scotty. I'm terribly sorry. I've got a teleporter here, but I haven't actually got around to plugging it in. You know, that would have been kind of shit, right? And so we had this technology, which is as close to teleportation as we're going to get, which is environmentally friendly, costs nothing, saves a huge amount of money, is actually a huge boon to productivity in some ways. Now, no one would have chosen 5 days a week all the time. I think that's probably fair. You know, I'm an extremist and I would have chosen 3 to 4. Other people would have chosen 1 to 1.5, or they would have said, I'll work from home on Fridays and I'll also occasionally work from home in the early mornings. You know, that's the kind of pattern I was looking for. I wasn't looking for 5 days a week. But nonetheless, the fact that we didn't even try anything, okay? I mean, I was just talking on an earlier podcast to some behavioral scientist folks. We, for some reason, I mean, are people just really unimaginative? I mean, that's one possibility. Is it that people have so little incentive to actually try anything new? In the modern working environment, has it become so detached from real productivity that actually the entire working environment in offices is all around signaling commitment, not around producing work at speed? Is it all about fitting in rather than being effective? Because the terrifying possibility that's occurred to me after this event, given our failure to experiment, And the other experiment, which I can just show you this little thing here, which is an Olympus. It doesn't come with the punk hairstyle. The reason is I often dictate when I'm outside on walks, so you have to have a windshield. And there's this German company called Gutmann, which for some reason sells kind of punk windshields. So I thought, okay, too cute not to buy. But what I discovered with this, you dictate, let's say, for 5 minutes, 6 minutes, okay? MP3, you can walk around, you can put it on a tripod, do what the hell you like. Stick out the little USB, plug it into your laptop, upload it to otter.ai, online AI-based transcription service. It churns away at it for about 2 or 3 minutes, which is actually rather satisfying. And it comes back with a transcript about 3 minutes later. Now, what you discover, I dictated for 6 minutes thinking, okay, I've got to write a Spectator article of about 625 words. I guess 6 minutes, you know, I would have broken the back of it, maybe with 300 words or something. What I discovered is 6 minutes dictation is 900 fucking words, which means theoretically, okay, if you were like A.A. Gill, I don't know if you remember A.A. Gill, the food critic of the Sunday Times, I think. A.A. Gill, some older journalists had this talent, very few do. But my hunch is that you can probably develop it. A.A. Gill was so fluent at speaking that when he came to deliver his articles for the Sunday Times, he rang up the transcription desk, the copy desk, and said, "Hi, it's A.A. Gill here. It's my, you know, 820 words for the Sunday Times." And then he just started speaking. He was dyslexic, interestingly, so that may have contributed to the talent. He just started speaking and then stopped on a very witty sentence and then said, "That should do it." And sure enough, they checked, it was like 810 words or 837. And he could effectively just speak an article. Now, maybe he was helped by being dyslexic. Maybe he was helped by growing up in an age where journalists practiced that a bit more. But it suddenly occurred to me, hold on, if this is really the case, you could theoretically, if you achieve that level of fluency, produce a 100,000-word hardback book in a day, right? Now, typing, there isn't a chance in hell you could do it in under 3 weeks, really, or two and a half weeks. If you were sufficiently good at talking interestingly, you could probably go and say that for my next book, I'm going to recruit three interesting blokes and mates, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to have platonic dialogues for about, you know, I don't know, one day a week for 4 days, and that'll give us, you know, I don't know, 300,000 words, and basically we'll just edit the bastard, you know, out of the, you know, edit the crap out of the thing, obviously, knock it down, get rid of the extraneous shit, and you'd probably have an okay book, right?
Yeah.
The other thing is editing's more enjoyable than writing, because when you're editing, you're adding value. When you're writing, you're merely translating from one medium to another. And the other great thing is it's a kind of gold gradient effect psychologically, which is what if you need to write 600 words, you've got 900 words down on the page, which are most of the words you'll need to reuse for the article. You kind of look at it and you go, well, I've broken the back of this thing. Okay. The worst bit's over. Now I've just got to edit it into shape. So it's half decent. And so, I mean, the interesting question is now, interestingly, Drayton Bird, the great copywriter I worked for, one of the most fantastic people you'll ever meet. I worked for when I first started work in advertising. He used to dictate all his work and he used to dictate all his memos and his emails and everything else. I don't think he typed actually at the time. And why did nobody ever say, actually, emails we should reply to? When I click reply on an email, the default mode should be to speak the answer. And it isn't, it's to type. This is wasting fucking hours every week of everybody's fucking time. And so my contention is if we just actually stopped signaling our commitment to how keen I am, how busy I am, how important I am, how rigorous I am, and just got on with work using the tools that were available to us, you can actually see a kind of literally, I don't use quantum leap because apparently physicists get very upset, but you could see pretty much a, I don't know, 20, 30% improvement in business productivity and decision-making, you know, maybe a 60% increase in the speed of decision-making. What's that worth, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be worth a hell of a lot. And, you know, I can't see any reason why the quality of decision-making is going to get worse. What will happen is that the speed of it and maybe the level of imagination that's put into it will just become better. And for whatever reason, we're not looking. Now, I think that if most travel and entertainment costs were incurred by junior staff, not senior staff, we would have seen junior staff forced to use Zoom, you know, like 6 years ago.
So, I mean, just moving on to the, so I was reading your audiobook, by the way, Alchemy. I was listening to it going around the park this morning and looking like a bit of an idiot as I was. It's also very funny. So I was going around doing that thing where you're going around smiling and laughing as people jog past looking like...
Yeah, it does make you look mad, doesn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely,
it is.
Yeah.
But so the sort of core of the book is counterintuitive ideas that, you know, the industry is overlooking. So, I mean, a lot of it's around, you know, whether it's a brand or research finding. But do you think within the industry ourselves, I mean, we've just spoken about Zoom, but, you know, are there many counterintuitive ideas that we...
Zoom itself is a counterintuitive idea, because when they first started, they got a lot of grief from investors who said, not illogically, okay, but as it turns out wrongly, look, okay, this is a category which is baked, okay? It's been done. And you're up against Microsoft with Skype, Apple, Google, Facebook, and somebody else as well, actually, come to think of it, okay? All of whom have mature offerings in this field, which are completely free. What in God's name makes you think you can actually make money out of offering this service? Now, Zoom is now worth about $16 billion, I think, at last check, maybe worth more now. And patently, pandemic aside, there were aspects of Zoom which were game-changing in the psychological space, but they were counterintuitive because they weren't the sort of thing that logical people think the human brain should care about. So, I mean, Skype, for example, made a mistake because it had the kind of telephone call model where you rang someone up, which is a massive imposition on someone else, you know. It makes you feel like a bit, you know, rude, and you'll never coordinate an 8-person meeting that way. You know, 3 people are going to forget somehow or cock it up. Other ones required you to download software or, you know, were generally a pain in the ass. Zoom just got across the threshold of crappiness where someone who is not very technologically capable could probably participate in a 1-hour meeting without fucking it up for everybody else. You're on mute, Dave. You're on mute. You know, to an extent where suddenly the benefit shone through and became apparent in a way that it never was with Skype and with other technologies. I think Skype was used quite heavily in the US, by the way. And I think one of the reasons was that we don't understand if we're in Europe, because in most European businesses, you can make international phone calls. In most American companies, you can't.
Yeah.
That people would use Skype whenever they made an international call. So there was some adoption of it there. But the point about those things is they were in that awful space where they were the kind of peak best technologies, which they were not quite good enough. You know, they were in the right place, but they weren't quite good enough for the big time.
I think, the lack of stability was always a big problem with them.
The stability, and also I think where Zoom got it right, by the way, which is also psychological, is the quality of audio is more important than the video, in the sense that we can cope with pixelation because our brains can correct for poor vision, but broken up sound drives us practically insane.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting case where, if you think about it, we evolutionarily, we've been faced with situations where you have fog or mist or poor eyesight or all manner of things where you have to compensate for deficiencies in vision. But we've never had to compensate for a world in the evolutionary context where people go, right? Okay. You know, that's just never happened. And so, I think the quality of sound, by the way, is much more important than we give it credit for. If you look at the importance of this technology in a kind of epistemological way, the fact that I'm wearing headphones and you're wearing fucking swanky headphones, actually, where'd you get them from? What are they?
They're some broadcast quality version that I invested in for the podcast. Yeah, I ended up having to buy a bloody big box to plug them into, and that goes into the computer. So
It's one of those. Yeah, of course.
So
you've got to plug it into a mixing deck before it goes into the USB.
Sound card. But are there places where you think, you know, advertisers are irrationally wasting money consistently, year in, year out. I have a friend who talks about search advertising, and you know, I think search is one of those.
You can't accuse that of being wasteful. Very likely, I mean, it could be wasteful.
Well, that was
but
my
doing some. Yeah.
I mean, no, his feeling was that it was like Yellow Pages. You were basically paying for something where you know the person's already looking for your product. You're often buying your own keyword.
Yeah.
You know, I did argue
it's a tax.
The question.
It's a tax. Yeah. And then you also get cases where I think people have gone advertising wrong by approaching it in completely the wrong way, by which I mean the need to sell MarTech and the need to treat advertising as a targeting optimization problem first and foremost, which, by the way, sometimes it is. I mean, close to the point of sale, okay, you know, conversion, all that stuff needs to be optimized first. Because if you haven't got all that stuff right, and if nobody can search for your product and find it, there's not much point in advertising it, okay? So if you haven't got that last mile conversion and, of course, repurchase, physical, you know, physical distribution in its widest definition, if you haven't got that stuff, there's no point in doing anything else. So those things are not unimportant, but they're not the whole game, okay? You know, it's a bit like saying, okay, you know, it's not the whole game, okay? And my argument is that there's a very large part of advertising that works in a way which is entirely probabilistic and fat-tailed and has nothing to do with the models of advertising which are generally used to optimize it at the kind of molecular level of the individual customer. And my argument there is that basically, if you're famous, okay, being famous will make you lucky in the future in ways that you can't necessarily predict in advance. And it will benefit you in the future in ways you can't necessarily attribute to your advertising or fame in retrospect. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try and be lucky. Just because you can't predict it and you can't measure it, that's a bit like saying you mustn't use a drug unless you know how it works at the molecular level, okay? We didn't know for decades how aspirin worked, but we knew what its effects were, and we decided that the effects were net, in specific situations, net positive. And so we used aspirin and we used paracetamol without actually knowing how it worked, okay? They were accidental discoveries. Now, similarly, it is perfectly acceptable to say the reason we do advertising is because we know that if your share of voice is in excess of your share of market, your brand tends to grow. And if your share of voice is below your share of market, your brand tends to shrink. Therefore, that on its own is information enough to decide that you probably want a share of voice. Okay, the fact that it isn't possible to understand how that works either predictively or in post-attribution at an individual level shouldn't prevent you from doing it, because certain parts of the future are going to be so freakish and uncertain and fat-tailed that you'll never be able to. When I launched my book, somebody sent some press release to the Chris Evans Breakfast Show, right? And it happened that Chris was in Cannes, I was in Cannes. Chris read the book, liked the book, invited me on the show. And the extraordinary thing was, for about 8-10 days on Amazon, I was like outselling The Hungry Little Caterpillar. I was outselling The Highway Code, okay? Now, no one would have sat down and said, okay, it's a book about evolutionary psychology with some relevance to marketing, but also other areas of business. We really need to get this on Virgin Radio, would they? Okay. That doesn't sound, and my point is that indiscriminate fame makes possible extraordinary tangential fortunes. And in many ways, you're never, okay, let's say you're a famous B2B brand, okay? People come to you with partnership ideas. People work for you for less money because they want you on their CV. People, you know, people want to work for you because they've heard of you, and therefore they want to work for someone they've heard of. When your chief executive rings someone up, people return the call, right? Now, all those things are to some extent increased by fame, okay? They're not attributable to it directly, and they certainly aren't attributable to an individual piece of marketing activity. But if something works in general, but you don't know how it works specifically, that isn't a reason not to do it. And so I worry that the probabilistic side of advertising, the other risk, of course, of becoming obsessed with targeting is that your targeting then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, quite often you have a product where actually you discover you have a completely different or complementary target audience to the one you initially envisaged. And so there's a huge danger if you're not careful that by refining your target audience too narrowly, you never discover other, because the idea, it's a marketing conceit, the idea that brands are demographically defined, or even that, you know, okay, you know, everybody goes, you know, Nike, it's a young person's brand. To be honest, if you look at any really successful brand, it sells to loads of people all over the flaming place, right? Okay. And it always amused me, actually. Who was it who used to write that? There was, I think it was Deborah Ross in The Spectator. Her dad was 80, and he used to put sellotape over the Nike logos on his Nike shoes because he said, you know, he said, I refuse to walk around advertising someone else's shoe brand. And Deborah said, Dad, you're an 82-year-old academic. Nike would pay you to cover the logos on your bloody shoes. But the point I'm making is that this idea that you can define your target audience in advance and that the target audience is somehow narrowly definable is not a safe assumption at all.
Yeah.
And so for lots and lots of probabilistic reasons, we need to understand that we have a deterministic advertising budget, which we probably need to optimize, but we also need a probabilistic advertising budget, which can never be optimized to the same extent, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. In fact, the value of spending money on probabilistic advertising has probably gone up. And for two reasons, one of which is your deterministic advertising is more effective over time, and therefore the payoff through doing the other stuff is greater. Secondly, it's a really, because so many companies now find it culturally impossible to do things that they can't justify at a kind of molecular level, your ability to horrify your finance director by doing mainstream advertising is now a significant competitive advantage over five of your competitors who would never get the budget to do that kind of thing.
Do you feel that the data-driven side is overrated? You know,
No, it's not over. It's complicated. I mean, it's not either or. And yeah. I like it, by the way. And by the way, you might learn things from it, and it's interesting. I think the attempts at kind of automation, and also the other my other huge complaint about it is that one, it's caused companies. Okay, a lot of companies are spending money on a MarTech stack. Okay. And for that amount of money, you could have hired David Abbott for his entire working life and still had change left over. Okay. And my argument is, look, one, you're far too focused on testing, on optimizing targeting rather than creative. Everybody who looks into this in any depth, including Google, who it's hardly in Google's interest to pretend that creative is really important and that targeting may be overplayed, right? But even Google say, when we look at this, the thing that is the big discriminator is the creative approach. That's where the magic comes from. You know, three different adjectives can multiply your sales by, 10 in case, you know, tweaking a headline can multiply sales by an order of magnitude. And yet all the testing goes on with shit lines being tested to small audiences, ever smaller audiences. Now, here's an interesting philosophical question, okay? What is the better ad? Okay, now I'm not supporting totally shit, useless, irrelevant targeting, right? I'm not suggesting going around, you know, absolutely impoverished. Well, even then there might be a small value to it. But I mean, I'm not supporting the idea that targeting can be appalling. But I would say that a great piece of creative that's averagely targeted is much more valuable than a boring bit of creative that's perfectly targeted. Because the second one merely recognizes and finds existing customers, whereas the first one creates them from elsewhere. Okay? And, you know, at the extreme level, there's this great joke, which is, you know, the man who you give three waiters a bunch of money off vouchers for pizza, and you're working in a pizza restaurant, and two of them walk around the streets, and they hand out all these money off vouchers, and at the end of the week, they look at the conversion rate. Okay, and two of these people who've been wandering up to people on the street have a conversion rate of about sort of 5%, Okay, 5% of the people who took one of the leaflets ended up redeeming it for a pizza. And then the third guy has a redemption rate of 100%. You go, this is unbelievable. How the hell do you manage to do this? And he goes, I just went up to the people queuing outside the restaurant. Okay. Now, it's perfectly possible to get your metrics completely wrong because every one of those people was ready to pay full price for a pizza when you gave them the money off voucher. And so the difference between efficiency and effectiveness is dangerous there because it's easier to measure efficiency than effectiveness. So you end up using the first as a proxy for the second. And proxy measures are really, really bad. I mean, proxy measures are really dangerous. Okay. If you, I'm going to turn into a bit of a weird dog eugenicist for a second here. Okay. But what you measure and incentivize really matters. If you look at dogs, right? Any dog that's been bred over generations as a kind of working dog, again, it's variation and selection, right? In other words, you want the dog to do a job, like, you know, not fighting. That's a bit nasty. I won't mention that. You know, keep that well. Keep me dog fighting career. Did I ever tell you this, by the way? Sorry, total aside. But there was a woman referring to the worst dates she'd ever had. It was a phone-in radio show, okay? And she quite liked the guy. And she said, I'd quite like to meet again. What about Thursday? And he replied with, I can't do Thursday because my dog's got a fight on. Okay. And funny enough, we heard this in the office. We occasionally use that. We still use that phrase. So it's just, you know, how about Wednesday week? No, I can't do Wednesday because my dog's got a fight on. But dogs that are bred, okay, the supreme dog, I think we have to acknowledge, is the Border Collie. I don't want to get into kind of, you know. But if you look at all those dogs, Labradors, Retrievers, etc., which are bred for a use case, okay, actual value, generally they're healthy, nice, sane, you know, good dogs. Not always perfect. I mean, a Border Collie is a bit too energetic if you're, you know, a pensioner, right? But nonetheless, they're well-rounded functional things. If you look at those dogs that are basically being bred by dog shows, in other words, by metrics, okay, you know, where it's desirable to have huge ears or a convex nose or concave nose or, you know, the shorter the legs, the better. And you have dog show metrics as opposed to real world metrics. The dogs that have been produced by those metrics always have, they end up getting diseases in the ears, or they have, you know, they go mentally weird, or, you know, everything goes flamingly wrong. Okay. And so, you know, if you go to one of those, you know, dog shows, you know, one thing I can guarantee you won't find at a dog show is a shepherd looking for a sheepdog. He's not interested in that shit. He wants to know whether the dog can herd sheep, right? And that's a mixed metric environment. The real world provides you with mixed metrics so that the dog evolves into a sensible trade-off between personality, leg length, all those other factors. If you start developing artificial metrics, and there's a thing called Goodhart's Law, which is about this. Any metric that becomes a target loses its value as a metric. That's a gross oversimplification, but it kind of does the job. Then I think you can end up doing things which are really, really stupid, because you're energetically pursuing the wrong thing.
I think one of the things I liked most about your book was the examples of products that I haven't really dwelt too much on.
That are completely batshit crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, the list gets longer when you think about it. So I'm going to include in this list Starbucks, Nespresso, Red Bull, Dyson. They're all billion-dollar companies. Zoom, which I mentioned earlier. Okay. Amazon Prime, which is okay, it's a sub product. I can probably add a few more. The Cadbury's cream egg, you might argue, etc. But there are lots of things which don't make sense at all. Okay, Red Bull, of course, is another one. If you had gone through any kind of rational process of selection, you never would have got there. And in fact, your colleagues would have had you fired before you launched them. Okay, so if you take Starbucks, okay, in 1990, had you gone around the United States and said, would you pay $3.20 for a coffee? Okay, 70% of people would have said no, and 25% of the, you know, a further 25% of people would have said no, but in even ruder terms, e.g., fuck off, right? Okay, maybe 2 or 3% of people would have gone, yeah, if it's really good because I'm loaded and I'm a hedge fund manager or whatever. But okay, there was no clue there that market existed, really. There was no clue before Dyson that there was a market for the $800 vacuum cleaner or the $400 hairdryer. There was no clue before Red Bull that there was a market for an expensive drink in a tiny can that didn't taste very nice. Amazon Prime and Zoom were both ridiculed by investors. Bezos himself was the only person who really believed in Prime in the early days. And all of those things, I think, are interesting because, A, reason and rationality will always get you to the same place as everybody else, okay? Now, the problem with that is it's usually an over-contested field. Capitalism contains this really interesting mechanism, which is the more counterintuitive the discovery, the more you are rewarded for making it, because you find yourself occupying a space where there's no one else. Okay? And so if you'd looked at the kind of bell curve of vacuum cleaner price pre-Dyson, you would have said, look, okay, mate, look, there are a few rich people buying a Miele here. A lot of people buy the Henry the Hoover or the Hetty the Hoover or whatever it is, or some cheap thing. It's a distress purchase. People only buy one grudgingly when they kind of, they're forced to move out of rented accommodation or their old vacuum cleaner breaks. And in any case, here's the clincher, Mr. Dyson. Anybody who can afford $800 to spend on a vacuum cleaner probably pays a cleaner anyway, so they're not even that bothered what they use, right? And so it'd be so easy to kill those things. Now, the problem is, I think, that there are lots of places, there are lots of solution spaces which logic cannot get you to. You might be able to post-rationalize the route subsequently, but you won't arrive at them through induction or deduction. I get them totally muddled up. You won't arrive, you will never arrive at that space through the standard marketing or business school toolkit, okay? Because everything that logic tells you to do is providing constraints on the solution space, typically to parts of the solution space which have already been well attested. Now, if they've already been tried before, there are, you know, three possibilities. One, there isn't actually a space there and everybody's failed. Two, if there is a space there, the space is overcrowded. Or three, which is a vague possibility, which I'd still consider, which is there used not to be a space there, but now there is, which is a bit the case of Zoom post-pandemic, you know.
And how much of that, you know, taking that
so
space?
I think there's a space now after the pandemic. People like Nikon and actually, let's go further. I mean, why don't we go to Leica, should make really blinged up video conferencing equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's now a space in that territory, which there wasn't before.
So do you think those to what extent do you think those companies are occupying a space and they're filling a niche, or to what extent were those spaces, did they create those spaces through marketing? You know,
well, I think the value of the entrepreneur is because the entrepreneur is free to be slightly stupid and weird, and because he doesn't have to justify his every action to a committee, he can get to experimental solution spaces which no conventional business will ever get to. I mean, even in the case of Nespresso, which was a complete anomaly, Nespresso only really survived apparently because they kind of lied to Nestle for about 3 years about how well it was doing. And even then, I think there was a very interesting kind of marketing genius who took it in and reinvented it as a lifestyle brand, which I think was spot on, by the way. I mean, it was kind of a nerdy B2B brand when it started, which was the logical space for it. Okay.
Yeah.
And when, you know, the Clooneyization of Nespresso was one of the really important things as well, by the way, is that nobody considers the extent to which marketing is an essential component of innovation. They tend to think of good ideas as selling themselves. And in fact, if you look at the history of nearly every innovation, the battle to get consumers to change their tastes and behavior is almost as significant as or in many cases more so than the technological challenge of coming up with the solution.
Yeah, I think
even things like vaccination, even things like penicillin, for God's sake, the medical fraternity was skeptical, so, you know, and so, you know, you need any big thing needs a marketing component to it. And that, by the way, tends to be less rational as well. It tends to be less, making marketing kind of linear and logical is dangerous, because part of the distinctive value of marketing is it's one of the few mindsets within a business which can take you to places which logic doesn't. Now, I'm not to say you can do things, well, I mean, in the case of Dyson, I really have to say, All I can do with things like Dyson is say, look at the pattern there, and does that tell you about an opportunity somewhere else? So with Starbucks, what I'd say is you can't charge $3.50 for a coffee if it's an adjunct to a meal or an adjunct to a sandwich or an adjunct to something else. But if you make your business all about coffee, so the only thing you sell is coffee, okay, people's willingness to pay more seems to shift.
Yeah.
In the same way that we spend more for sunglasses at Sunglass Hut than we would at Boots, right? When the setting is all about one. Now, oh, here's another one, Five Guys, okay? Which I really find interesting, because what is innovative about Five Guys? Product's very good, okay? But the burger is so fucking expensive if you look at it in a detached way, okay? That I'm sure that when Five Guys went around saying, would you pay $9 for a burger? They got a lot of people going, piss off, right? Now, what's interesting about Five Guys is the price is cleverly hypothecated so that the peanuts are free. The fries are absurdly generous because they give you an extra scoop that you didn't even ask for. The refills are free. So the only expensive things in Five Guys are the burger. You pay a bit if you want cheese or bacon on the burger. All the toppings are free, interestingly. Okay. The peanuts are free. The refills are free. The only expensive things are the burgers and the milkshake. Everything else is actually highly competitively priced. Now, what's interesting about that is it's hypothecation. It's people happily paying more for the component of the meal where they think makes a difference, okay? And therefore, in a way, you can charge a lot more when people feel that the extra money is going to the thing they really care about.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So now you can take Five Guys and you can apply that to the tax system. So if you paid for things people don't like paying for out of sales tax or value-added tax, and income tax all went towards the health service and education, people will be much happier paying income tax, right?
Yeah.
And so Five Guys have sort of discovered hypothecated pricing. So what you can do with behavioral science, this is where the magic lies, is you can look for recurring patterns and go, okay, what's the Five Guys of tax? Or what's the Amazon Prime of hotels? Or what's the Red Bull of, you know, chocolate?
Yeah.
Okay. I bet there's a market for like health giving chocolate that actually only half tastes good, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can actually go and ask those questions. Because I think what we're doing is we're deterministic creatures. As Jim O'Shaughnessy said to me in New York yesterday or the day before, we're deterministic brains living in a probabilistic universe. And the skill we really need for business isn't like pretending it's Newtonian physics and going, look, doesn't this look all like science? The skill we really need is pattern recognition.
Well, when you look at the creatives that you see today, do you feel that, you know, the creativity, particularly when it comes to video and TV, is the quality improving over time, or is there a sort of glory days of advertising that we should be looking back to?
There's still good stuff. But what I do notice is that there's been and by the way, a guy called Orlando Woods has written a fantastic book about this, which is based on the work of Ian McGilchrist, the book, particularly the book, The Master and His Emissary, about brain hemisphere imbalance. What is fair to say about advertising is it's become more and more, and I'm either using this correctly or metaphorically, and I'm not a good enough neuroscientist to know which, but it doesn't really matter. It's become more and more left brain. It's become more and more about reason and argument and advertising, and less about emotion.
Yeah.
So doing something like a Hovis ad, okay, because basically, you know, first of all, you'll have to bloody well get it through a load of stupid testing, which will require you to ask stupid questions like, does the ad convey this, that, the other? How many bits of factual information does an ad convey? Which may be, to be honest, irrelevant in the scheme of things. Okay. Then you'll also have to pass a whole level of people going, but we're spending £3 million on this and it doesn't say it's made with 7.3% wholemeal, right? And so the left brain business culture, which I think has been further exacerbated by the overuse of email and spreadsheets and very, very kind of cold communications media, has essentially had its effect on advertising. So the kind of feel good, funny, charming advertising. There are still exceptions and outliers, but the kind of advertising that is what you might call Hovis-y or Cinzano-y, you know, or Yellow Pages-y, okay, where it just tells a really nice, warm human story and we all go, okay, which is engaging both halves of our brain, that is rarer and rarer, really. And by the way, part of this, I have to admit, is a product of the fact that advertisers aren't the same people they were in 1988. So if you rewind to about 1992, two-thirds of ad spend in the UK was packaged goods. Now, that would include beer, detergent, soaps, you know, fast-moving consumer goods of some kind. And those companies, the companies that produced those goods, were highly marketing-led. You know, the chief executive of Unilever has probably done a stint in marketing at some point in his life, right? Now, if you fast forward to, well, never mind now, or even 7 or 8 years ago, okay, that two-thirds is now under a quarter. And the slack's been taken up by mobile phone networks, broadband providers, insurance comparison websites, cable TV providers, Sky, totally different categories. All of those categories tend to have a financially driven mindset or an engineering driven mindset, not a marketing driven mindset. And that, it shouldn't surprise us that that's had an effect on the kind of advertising that gets produced. Because if you're selling knickknacks or what's-its or beer, okay, or cigars, okay, you accept the fact pretty readily that we're not going to be talking about leaves here. And actually, we're not going to be talking about price. And we're not going to be talking about all these things. What we're doing here is producing a fantastic aura around this thing, okay? And that, you know, we're going to be exploiting halo effects and we're going to be generally going for all-out fame. And the emotional response is really what matters. This is a right brain product, you know, bought in part by the right brain, which all products are, by the way, including B2B products. But further away you get from those categories, the more the businesses are in denial about that simple fact. You know, I'm sure that Dyson believes that everybody buys a Dyson because of the superior engineering and the fact that it doesn't lose suction. I don't think that's irrelevant to the success of Dyson, but if you'd made Dysons opaque and beige, nobody would have bought them. Certainly not at those prices, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, those decisions are much more right brain than the company itself is willing to let on. And an old colleague of mine called Peter Wallach, brilliant Saatchi's copywriter, he used to say that he always found importers were much better clients than manufacturers were. Because the importer basically said, I bought the rights to this weird beer. Let's just have a bang at making it famous to see if I can be the next Copperberg or the next, Bailey's or the next, you know, whatever it may be, Magnus, okay? I'm just going to have a bash at this. So, okay, it's Irish or it's something or other. So we'll make a load of noise about that and we'll do, you know, we'll see what happens. Now, the person who actually brews the beer is a pain in the ass because he spends 90% of his time agonizing about hop prices or, you know, or fermentation or the fact that, you know, there's a blockage in the sprocket, okay? And so he thinks the advertising should all be about the beer. So Peter Wallach always said that if you've got an importer as your client, you're onto something because they accept the fact that, look, all I want to do is make this damn thing famous and hope I get lucky, basically. Whereas the guy who's invested his whole life in the damn thing and spends most of his life worrying about the, you know, the cost of yeast, okay, isn't going to have the same mentality to promoting something which is 100% of his life.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think... any sort of founder of a business, they're all, yeah, myself included.
They can be really painful, yeah.
Yeah, you have an attachment, you have an idea, you have a, that's not who we are, you know, it's sort of bound up with your personality and your inner brain rather than, you know, just completely emotionally distanced and thinking, okay, what is this
I think thing? Bryson's interesting because he produces good advertising quite often, but can be an absolute pain in the ass to work for.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the, you know, there are trade-offs there. Sometimes they can produce brilliant stuff.
So Well, thanks. You're a regular contributor to The Spectator, and you're wear your heart on your sleeve as a Tory. And I think that you sort of mentioned a few times that, you know, for you, that's you're basically a minority within the industry.
Well, being an avowed Tory, I think there are more. I'm not that Tory, by the way. The reason I'm conservative, I'm not a party line Tory remotely.
Yeah.
The reason I'm really conservative is actually because of what conservatism isn't. So I think the political right, and a lot of people think this, made a big mistake getting into bed with neoliberal economics. Okay, now it was convenient, okay, at a time when you really needed to fight a prevailing, you know, default in the other direction. But you should view that, you know, neoliberal economics has its uses, but I don't think you should become ideologically attached to it particularly. It's just one lens of looking at the world. It's not a useless way of looking at the world. It doesn't provide all the answers. Now, what I like conservatism for is for what it isn't, which is it isn't an attempt to shoehorn the whole of messy reality into a single ideological structure. Okay, so that's the real appeal. It's what it isn't.
Yeah.
In that I find all attempts to... It's natural in the human brain, because it's a sense-making organ, to try and become a kind of what's that guy called, Owen Jones or something, isn't it? The Guardian.
Owen Jones, you know, yeah.
Where he gets up in the morning and he looks at the sunset in Marxist terms. You know what I mean? You get the impression he kind of looks up and goes, sunset. Now, what does this tell me about the inexorable rift in the interdependent process of social metabolism or whatever? You know, and the point is, it's a natural tendency. We love a tube map, right?
Yeah.
Because the tube map basically makes London comprehensible. But London is not the fucking tube map. I mean, it doesn't even include railways or buses, for crying out loud, or taxis, or walking, or cycling, okay? But the extent to which people want to... And this is why, actually, I think people who aren't interested in politics are actually more intelligent about politics than people who are. Because the need to present yourself as having a consistent one-size-fits-all framework for political decision-making in order to look decisive, rather than a much more experimental, a much more Aristotelian kind of empirical approach, okay? Yeah, one thing with conservatism, okay? The minimum wage is contrary to most neoliberal economic dogma, okay? But weirdly, things like dropping the tax rate on, you know, below ultimately £12,500 a year, getting rid of income tax below that level, and also, which originated, interestingly, in a right-wing think tank, and then made its way to the Liberal Democrats, and then got injected into the Conservative Lib Dem coalition. Nobody's planning to reverse that, right? Because it kind of works. The minimum wage kind of works. I think there are all kinds of reasons, psychological reasons, why the minimum wage actually does more good than harm, actually. And the reason for that is really simple, which is that it is not optimal for businesses to pay people as little as they can get away with. But it's a very easy way to explain to your board of directors why you pay people what you do. So actually, you should pay above the market rates, because it pays back in terms of longevity, it pays back in terms of commitment, it pays back in terms of low training costs, lots and lots of things like that, okay? So, but it's very hard to go into your board and say, most people pay call center operatives $8.50 an hour, but I'm going to pay them $9.50. Because it's a really tough argument to a bunch of people who've been brought up on kind of economic theory. Okay. Weirdly, when the conversation is about a chief executive, all those rules change, don't they? You know, when we're hiring a chief executive, no, he's going to be have to pay at least £1 million a year, because here it's the war for talent. You know, the battle for this miraculous talent to talk to a fucking city analyst like five times a week and talk bollocks about your EBITDA. That's apparently a really, really rare skill. But being a call center worker, no, that's basically a commodity. Okay. Bollocks, okay? A really good call center worker is worth five times what an average call center worker is worth, if you could actually do the maths and the measurement. So my justification for conservatism is a bit like Nassim Taleb's kind of via negativa thing. The great thing about conservatism, and anything about what it is, it's what it isn't. It's basically, look, there are probably two sides to every argument. That sometimes there's more than one right answer to a problem. It's the only acceptable empirical kind of approach to a messy world, which is a product of emergence, not design. And, you know, all those things like Marxism and so forth, which are perfect, assuming that the world was designed and hadn't evolved, okay? There's a wonderful phrase about that, which is probably the best ever put down, which is that, I think it was E.O. Wilson, who's the world's leading expert on ants and social insects, and someone described Marxism to him, and his reply was, brilliant theory, wrong species. And the point is that in certain, you know, in certain hyper-social insects, you do practice a kind of Marxism, okay? But basically, humans aren't like that. And what's interesting about humans, by the way, is that there's a wonderful phrase, one of the best phrases I've ever heard in politics, and I can't remember who said it. It might be, oh, crikey, I wish I could remember. It might be someone called Graham. But it said, interestingly, it said, at the national level, I'm a libertarian. At the state level, I'm a Republican. At the town level, I'm a Democrat. In my family, I'm a socialist. And with my dog, I'm a communist. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. And the point he makes is that actually the forms of politics we should use are scale dependent.
Yeah. Do you feel modern conservative, modern conservatism is really that divorce from ideology? I mean, for me,
it should be.
Brexit epitomizes.
Brexit's perfectly consistent because it simply says that there are costs as well as benefits to scale. And any honest person should acknowledge that there are, that there are disadvantages to being part of an entity of which you only form a 26th part. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you lose a huge amount of optionality. You lose a degree of autonomy, and you lose significantly. You lose, particularly in a country in an entity which speaks 26 languages. You have no real political accountability at the top. Okay, because the way in which political accountability works in a country is that people get sick of the wanker who's in charge and they all change their mind and they get rid of them. That's not a bug, that's a feature, okay? You know, when a party runs out of ideas, when it starts to become corrupt or whatever, you get rid of it. And it you know, when you look at something like, a change of government in the UK, it's a total sweeping away of a whole apparatus, okay? Now, if you have 26 countries mostly speaking different languages, all watching completely different media, where, by the way, in the UK media, you probably get, 10 times as much coverage of the US as you do of continental Europe?
Yeah, probably.
That's about right, isn't it? Yeah. We basically watch Anglo-American TV, don't we, with a bit of Australian shit thrown in. You know, by the way, I don't quite know why that is to that extent. Because it was undoubtedly an obstacle to, you know, our media environment. The media are all very remaining, but I mean, they didn't do much to create a sense of common European identity, not least in just giving it no coverage whatsoever.
I think in other countries
it's perfectly consistent to go no, to be absolutely honest. And let's be honest about this. I mean, I voted Remain, but what made me almost flip was the prevalence of very passionate Remainers in positions of power was completely disproportionate. I don't mind people going, I think the European Union is quite a good idea, really. What I suspect is that there are about 10 to 15% of people, there are probably about 20% of people in the UK who would happily become part of the United States, right? Okay. Or they'd happily be part of a union with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, you know, a few other countries like that, okay? Now, they never actually say that because it makes you sound a bit of a lunatic, right? Now, interestingly, I think there are 10% of people who want to be part of a European superstate. They prefer it. For whatever reason, okay, they never say it because what it is the European project's a bit of a shapeshifter. It's actually a political project masquerading as an economic project, okay? So it's a little bit of a transformer there. When it suits it, it just says, no, this is just all about economic pragmatism. But it isn't all about that, okay? Now, I suspect those 10% of people in the British population who'd really rather be subsumed in a European superstate, I would imagine in the upper echelons of government, the civil service, etc., it's more like 30%, 40%.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, people who voted Leave weren't necessarily voting against Europe. They were voting against what they suspected to be an ulterior motive in large numbers of people in power and government.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we only narrowly escaped the euro, which was a shit idea. Okay, one of the planks, free movement of people, the euro, sense of, I don't know, they're four of them, aren't they, pillars or something. Now, the euro is a dumb idea, right? Okay. The problem is not that it's a dumb idea. The fact that the mentality is that it's unreversible. And that's the real problem of Europe. It's not anything to do with Europe or close European cooperation. It seems to have a mechanism which doesn't, it's not capable of basically, what's the French phrase, something or other, pour mieux sauter. It's not even capable of stepping backwards. The answer to any failure is more Europe, essentially. And that's deeply unconservative, of course, as a project.
Yeah. I would be one of the people who, you know, I realize we're heading towards a super state, an evolving one. And I wouldn't want to wave a magic wand and have it ready tomorrow. But I think, like, the future is in working together. And I mean, it's just...
As a Brit, I think that's really problematic. And actually, for the Irish, I think it's problematic because we speak English. And let's be honest about this, okay? Where do British and Irish people go if they emigrate? They don't really go to continental Europe. You go to United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, right?
True.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're being slightly dishonest if we're looking at voting with our feet. I'll give you an example. Let me get this right. The British emigre population, the British-born population of Australia, is greater than the number of people who are British people working in Europe. That doesn't include people who retired to Spain because they're criminals or whatever, you know. You know, that doesn't include some bloke in a kind of, you know, towelling robe and a gold chain going, any chance of a cup of tea, love? My phone's like sandpaper. Doesn't include those people. But people actually working in Europe who are British-born, English-speaking, are outnumbered by the number of British people working in Australia. Perth, Australia, is 1/8 British-born. So if we actually look at our real behaviour as people, now, if you had freedom of movement between Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, the UK, Canada, my one problem would be the UK would empty, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it would be like this extraordinary exodus, I would have thought. If the populations were swapped, Britain would be full of Australians going around looking at castles and stuff and going off to Paris for a weekend. But actually, if you look at, you know, if you're honest about it, if you're English speaking, it's difficult to say you're completely aligned in a European state because you also belong to this kind of Anglosphere thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I wouldn't deny that. I don't see the two as mutually exclusive.
No, they're not totally mutually exclusive. Yeah. I grant that. No, but
I'd be more wary of political change. And I think for me, we're talking about this longer than I thought we'd be, but where the UK finds itself now, for example, with we've got Trump on the one side, who's, you know, very much a unilateralist. Then the other side, we've got China, and all of a sudden, you know, the Great Eastern relationship is just like kaput. I'm feeling anxious about this country.
That might be, depending on how things turn out, that might be Trump's. There's always the possibility with people like Trump, which is they're wrong about everything small. But with the benefit of history, you're right about one or two big things.
Yeah.
Okay. And probably relations with China were too naive beforehand.
I'd 100% agree
so,
with you.
So trade doctrine essentially said, actually, we cannot even conceive of any way in which greater free trade and, you know, free mutual, you know, mutual involvement in other people's economies cannot be beneficial.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it can be fucking dangerous, mate. That's what it can be. And so, you know, in a weird way, you know, Reagan was a case where, you know, what you could say about Reagan was, you know, I mean, he was, by the way, you know, an order of magnitude better than Trump in most respects. I mean, not least in his speaking style and everything else and his ability to bring a country together after all as well. But he was right about the big, you know, when you look at it, really, actually, we get all excited about did Dominic Cummings go to Durham shit, which the news media feeds us with. But actually, the important shit happens slowly and we don't even notice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, the really big shit isn't newsworthy because it's just part of a gradual process that we think to be inevitable. And by at the very least saying, actually, this isn't inevitable. You know, offshoring of manufacturing isn't inevitable. Mm. You know, I might bollock General Motors if they open another factory in Mexico rather than Alabama, and it isn't inevitable. Okay, simply by messing up the just by messing up the lazy assumptions of businesses. Because businesses are really only good to the extent to which they're disrupted. I don't think you should actually featherbed business existence, because making existence tough for businesses forces them to adapt and experiment, which is their real virtue. You know, it's the experimentation and the adaption that delivers most of the value, not the efficiency. That's boring. I mean, that's just table stakes.
What do you think of what's happening to the media at the moment? You know, we're obviously seeing that, you know, the sort of traditionally large media institutions coming under serious strain. You know, the pandemic has sort of accelerated things, and you know, there is the nation state and democracy. You know, there is, the media plays a very important role in sort of having this sort of external accountability in terms of communicating back to the people what's going on. It looks like we're starting to lose them, and at the moment we're, you know, there seem to be or are we, you know,
I think the news media is dangerously weird, actually, that it, first of all, okay, you've had this event at the New York Times where Danny, can't remember her surname now, I wrote this thing saying that, you know, Twitter should practically be on the masthead of the New York Times because it does most of the... That you have this business where the media is getting upset because it's now forced to tailor its opinions to really what is a tiny minority of extreme opinion that is very vociferously expressed on a few social media. Okay, no one in the pub says this shit, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine a pub where someone someone might say, you misgendered me, and you go, oh, sorry, mate, right? Okay. Okay, right. And by the way, not, you know, it's perfectly, one of the interesting things is that by over-educating our population, which sounds like a terrible thing to say, but we've created this weird population who thinks there should be rules. Real life is just messy, okay?
Yeah.
You know, you can cope with a degree of ambiguity in things, you know. I can accept the fact that in every single meaningful respect, someone who is transgender should be addressed, treated, etc., as female, but that there might be an issue in sport. Okay. That's the way the world works. There are, you know, there are ambiguities here and there dotted around. Okay. And I get around my business. Okay. Without needing to settle that ambiguity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Because that's just how things are. Now, this idea that you must take an absolute position and any deviation from that position basically means you are a Nazi, that doesn't exist among normal human interaction, does it? It's a product of social media, really, and it's a product of academia. It only really applies in those incredibly rarefied atmospheres where you can afford to spend your life around things that work in theory but not in practice.
And I think even those extremists in person would generally be... You know,
they're probably quite nice.
Yeah, I
think we need to get a bit Marshall McLuhan about this. Is text a bit shit? In other words, if you replace most political shows with a picnic, okay, and you allowed the people to picnic together before you actually started the cameras rolling, all right, what you'd end up with is something like the relationship between Portillo and Abbott on, what was it, the Weekly Politics? With Andrew Neil, okay? Yeah. Which is a completely amicable, sane discussion between... I went into the UK Houses of Parliament, okay? And what appeared to me happening was something extraordinary, which was lots of people from different political parties getting together in multi-party rooms to discuss problems and solve them together to the best of their collective ability. Now, if you read the news coverage of politics, you would never be aware that this happens at all.
Yeah.
Okay. That people on both parties get together and go, I'm worried about child poverty. Is there, you know, what are the best approaches to solving this problem? Let's have a bit of an argument, but a bit of a discussion, and we'll arrive at something which might be better than any of us would have come up with individually. Okay. That's how human discussion worked. And there's a lot of that going on in politics. No person in the public would have any clue that that takes place at all, because the only thing they're interested in is a fucking spat. And I notice this because you get rung up and they go, I want you to appear on this show. And you go, oh, yeah, no, I'm very interested in this subject, very interesting topic. One thing you do need to understand is my views on this topic are slightly nuanced. Okay. And immediately you get a phone call saying your presence is no longer required. Okay. If you're not a nutbag. Now, so these people complaining about Twitter. Okay, but it's kind of like who bloody sows the storm, reaps the whirlwind, or whatever it is. Because journalists were exploiting this bullshit for 7 years, right? They're going, oh, brilliant. Great thing with Twitter is I can always find someone who has a really extreme opinion. So if anybody does something a bit iffy, I can go and find 10 people who'll be outraged by it. So rather than wearing out shoe leather, as journalism used to be, or wearing out a Rolodex by finding someone who has an opinion against this, who, by the way, by the law of averages, will probably be comparatively sane, right? Yeah. They wear out a mouse pad looking for, you know, basically a celebrity nut job, of which there is a fairly abundant supply on social media. And they create this completely artificial. If you look at ordinary pubs, okay, you'll know. I mean, you'll know this. Irish politics, by the way, is completely baffling to all of us because it's the only country where there isn't really a right or left, is there? That's
it. It's all a bit centery and maybe, this swing off.
Someone described it to me as saying that is it Fianna Gael are slightly more competent, but you wouldn't want to go to the pub with them.
I think that.
Is that basically about right?
That sums them up. But then if you went to the pub of Fianna Fáil, they'd have their hand in your pocket and you'd realise your wallet was gone. So, yeah, it's a bit of both. Yeah. But they're pretty much two centrist parties. We're pretty much a centre.
Very interesting case. But, I mean, normal pub conversation embraces people in conditions of complete civility, who have differing views, who go away respecting the different views. This shouldn't be difficult, right?
Yeah.
In business, by and large, nobody has really bonkers views in business because exposure to business teaches you that actually life's a bit complicated. You know, there are right-wing people who are really nice and honourable and there are left-wing people who are unbelievably greedy assholes and indeed vice versa. So your attempts at a kind of, bifurcated definition of the world break down pretty quickly in a business setting.
Yeah, I think some of the worst people I've met were working for charities.
Interesting, yeah, because it's interesting because it's often called a thing called patholog. Well, one argument is that when you spend your whole life doing something you believe to be worthy, you feel you've got a bit of it's moral licensing. You've got a bit of a license to be an asshole in your spare time. Yeah, you don't want to rent your holiday home to doctors, you know, because they've spent the rest of the year doing life-saving operations, so they'll be dickheads when it comes to, like, you know, paying up or, you know, cleaning the swimming pool or something. And so then, you know, life's just complicated like that. It's pretty messy. That's fine. We can cope with it. We'll look for patterns. Don't look for rules. Is basically what I say. You know, in any complex system, there aren't any rules. What you can do is find recurring patterns and use them to expand your solution space. And so this obsession with creating, you know, essentially reporting what is often synthetic outrage.
Yeah.
Right. Which has also led to people doing things which are completely counter. Not only ineffectual, they're actually counterproductive in supporting various campaigns by simply going, if I can annoy these other people, I will deem my protest to be a success. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and often the most passionate people on either side of any particular interest group are more committed to signaling their commitment to the cause, to their peer group, than they are to solving the problem. And so in many cases, the extreme positions they adopt are actually inimical to solving the problem. And there are all sorts of reasons about this. Cass Sunstein does a lot of work in kind of group polarization, which shows it. But the media has made this possible by refusing to filter out. You know, some editor should have said, look, anybody can find 10 nutters on Twitter. Go and find me some intelligent opinion about this. And there's also something weird about social media, if you think about it. Back in the 18th century in London, when people rowed on riverboats, apparently they shouted abuse at people on the bank. And people on the bank would basically shout wanker at the people on the boats. And people on the boats would shout fatso at the person walking on the bank. I think that's a bit of a weird thing to do. And then you realize that, of course, 18th century London on a boat was the first place in world history, apart from ancient Rome and a few Chinese cities, on a river, okay, where you could abuse someone and they couldn't punch you in the face. Yeah. So in the standard environment, if you lived in a town of 8,000 people and you shouted wanker at someone, you'd bump into that same person, okay, 3 days later, and they'd punch you in the face, okay, or otherwise exact some other vengeance upon you. But you had a population of about 1 million, and you were on a boat, and you had a reasonable expectation that you'd never see these people ever again. And so normal levels of courtesy were suspended. And social media is just a digital version of a 18th century London boat.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. I think if we could all redirect, report tweets and it was to go to the tweeter's mum, I think, you know, we'd all sort of up our game instantly. So if I was to give you 10 million to invest in any business in the industry, who would you invest in and why?
Crikey.
This is a question that always catches people off guard.
Does it have to be a media business?
It does, no, it can be... I used to restrict it to media and advertising, but I think it's often even more interesting if somebody has ideas outside of the industry.
Oh, I'd invest that easily in creating a behavioural science and complexity lab. In other words, a consulting firm that operated on a completely different premise to all existing consulting firms by looking at things through a different lens. In other words, the lens of psychology and complex systems. In other words, the purpose of this consultancy would be once every 6 years it should come up with another Red Bull, not that it should reduce Red Bull's distribution and logistics costs by 5%. So I think the exploit-explore side of capitalism has got out of whack.
Does the genetic component ever come up in behavioral economics?
Yeah. I think that you can't fully do behavioral economics without the kind of foundational discipline has to be evolutionary psychology.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that, you know, we have the brains we have, and in many cases, maybe they were optimized for a different environment in which we find ourselves now, e.g. sweet foods, perhaps, okay? We have a disproportionate propensity to consume them because for most of our evolutionary life, they were scarce. And equally, in many cases, the way in which our brains work is actually much more intelligent than logical people realize. Because by making illogical decisions, what you are doing is you are factoring in things into your decision which can't fit in a spreadsheet or can't fit in a model, but which are nonetheless highly relevant.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the problems when you make a business decision is the quality of the decision from the point of view of the decision maker is determined by its defensibility, not by the quality of the outcome. And so a lot of business people would rather make a safe decision, which you can't get blamed for, than an imaginative decision, which in the event of failure would get them fired.
Yeah, yeah.
And so our approach to risk, I think, within institutional decision making is needs to be improved. And our understanding that there's always a trade-off between exploit and explore.
What are the circumstances in companies where... You know, people do have the freedom to take those risks. I mean, Burger King are somebody who at the moment are, you know, they're doing all sorts of stuff that would be deemed risky by in other companies. I mean, how do you take off the shackles?
Yeah, I mean, number two companies or challenger brands have a greater license to do this because there is the fundamental argument, which is they will always be able to outspend us. So we need to compete in terms of a different kind of noise, if you like. And so challenger brands and new brands have a license to do it. But it's interesting how unsuccessful large established companies mostly are at the business of innovation because they aren't allowed to explore solution spaces that are not accessible through the standard ladder of logic.
Yeah.
Quite often what you need to do, I think, is use creativity to teleport yourself to a new solution space and then build the ladder of logic. If you think instinctively there's something here that really appeals to me, you can then say, is there actually a ladder of logic which I can now build? Having climbed the mountain, I can now see where the route up the mountain lies. But this route would have been completely invisible to me when I was at the bottom of the mountain.
Yeah, I think it's a yeah.
And so I think leaps to the imagination are permissible in science, by the way, as well as they are in business. And yet in most settings, they're not.
Yeah. I think it's always a difficult thing. I think the unknown is always just going to be a fearful path for people to go down. But I think to have confidence in people, I suppose, is the...
There's a great Niels Bohr quote where he said, I think you're not thinking, you are merely being logical, which is a really interesting thing because it sounds such a silly thing to say. But I think he's making a point there, which is really valuable.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I'm conscious that we're going over our time, and I've got to leave you to your seagulls. And
this has been a huge pleasure. Thank you very much, Lee.
It's been absolutely fantastic, really, George, from start to finish.